Well, this is not a boat accident. It wasn't any propeller. It wasn't any coral reef. And it wasn't Jack the Ripper.
It was a shark.
Just when you thought it was safe to open your podcast app.
This shark, swallow you whole.
It's time for the 3 Men in a Retrospective's look at all 4 films contained in the Jaws franchise.
Oh, boys! I think he's come back for his noon feeding.
To help celebrate the original film's 50th anniversary, Garrett.
Maybe he's not in the dungeon, he's already eaten my plate!
Matt.
Polly sent me to find you to tell you that there's a bunch of Boy Scouts out in April Bay doing their mile swim for their merit badges.
And Adam.
Y'all know me. Know how I earn a living.
Have dared to swim the waters started by director Steven Spielberg way back in 1975.
Jesus H. Christ.
From the blockbuster original.
I got the creme de la creme.
All the way to the 1987 final film, Jaws the Revenge.
What are you, some kind of half-ass astronaut?
The guys will look at each film and determine if Jaws is indeed a one-movie franchise.
I want to be sure. You want to be sure. We all want to be sure, okay?
Smile, percolated media listeners.
Mr. Mayor, Chief, ladies and gentlemen.
The 3 Men in a Retrospective's look at Jaws begins now.
Hang on to your socks, lads.
Jaws the Revenge, released July 17th, 1987. Budget was $23 million, box office $51.9 million, and this was directed by Joseph Sargent. Matt, we've covered some bad movies on this podcast. A few years ago, we reviewed what many consider to be one of the worst movies of all time in Batman and Robin. I think all of us conceded that while it's not a great film, it definitely doesn't warrant that bit of history. Matt, Jaws Revenge, is this one of the... I'm not saying how you feel about it, but is this one of the... considered one of the worst movies we have ever reviewed?
Well, first of all, I would like to make an addendum to your previous statement. I do think Batman and Robin actually deserves its reputation. Okay. So I want to strike that from the... amend that statement to the record. This is pretty notorious as well, and there's a lot of similarities. This is the 4th movie in a franchise that some argue the law of diminishing returns. And also, it's kind of similar because of the certain people that are associated with it that have gone on to make jokes about being in it to the point where they can't do interviews without either apologizing for it or saying that they did it strictly for the money, as Michael Caine has talked about routinely. So there are some comparisons to be made for sure.
Definite comparisons. Now, Adam, you had mentioned that this was a first-time viewing for you. You had known of its reputation, correct?
I had heard of its reputation mostly through interviews with Michael Caine and such, but... again, I was one that mixed up 3 and 4 and who was in which one, but I definitely knew that this was, I mean, let's call it what it is, it's the franchise killer. So I absolutely knew at least its reputation in Hollywood history.
Now, critics were pretty harsh on last week's film, Jaws 3, but it still garnered a profit that made over $80 million. So Sid Sheinberg decided that he was going to go ahead and make another one. And, you know, I have to say, and Matt, tell me if you agree with this. Put his wife here, Lorraine Gary, pulled her out of retirement to be in this film. She's the head of the cast. She's the first name on the screen when the credits roll. This is a vanity project, isn't it?
Yes and no. If you're a pessimist or a cynic, you can look at that approach. But I am also going to give a certain amount of credit that you had a genre film like this, and we'll give our thoughts on the movie throughout this discussion. But a lot of these movies starred men, and the women were entirely in the background, supporting characters at best. I will give this movie a certain amount of credit that it's putting a woman first and foremost. And, you know, she's the one who has all the agency. You could argue the shark does as well, which I can't believe the thought process associated with this movie. So to your point, I agree with a portion of it, but at the same time, it is doing something that was against the norm.
All right, so... he gets this Steve DeJarnette to write a script, And then it's shelved pretty quickly, and Sid Sheinberg ends up asking Joseph Sargent to come in and direct the movie. Now, as you recall, guys, we talked about Joseph Sargent when we talked about the first Jaws, and that he had made the film that, according to Spielberg, was the one that made him want to cast Lorraine Gary in the film, not the fact that his boss's wife was Lorraine Gary herself. So they were kind of rotating around each other around that time. And at that point, Sargent, he was going to direct Taking a Pelham 1-2-3, and which is a pretty well-regarded movie. A movie I still haven't seen, by the way, the original.
How have you not seen that
movie? I don't know. It's one of those.
It's legit. It's one of my favorite movies.
It's one of those movies that I have. It has looked at me for years, and probably kind of like the Jaws sequels to Adam. I just never decided to hit play on them. I will eventually.
I will challenge you to watch it over the next week if you have the time. I think you'll see that not only. I mean, look, they remade it. Tony Scott remade it, which the remake is okay. I don't think it's great, but I also found it kind of redundant because you're remaking a bona fide classic. And quite frankly, Joseph Sargent is one of those directors that he made one of the greatest movies of all time, and nothing else comes remotely close except for this movie, possibly, question mark.
Well, so when Sargent got the job, he actually did make a call to Steven Spielberg, asking him if he had any advice while he was making this film. And all Spielberg told him was, have someone you love on speed dial, because you're going to want to rant every single day you get off that set. Not a bad piece of advice there. The weird thing that Sheinberg did, though, he gave Sargent Cope de Grog to hire who he wanted. He hired this Michael de Guzman to write a script. This guy, I think this was his first feature script, and I think his last. He did a lot of TV after, but they were coming up with concepts, and Sheinberg was shooting down a lot of them, but they eventually ended up with this one out of desperation. And once they were agreed upon to do this concept, they ran with it. And if you ask Sargent, and I even watched an interview with Lance Guest in the lead up to this, they knew they were making something bad when they were making it. But this is what the studio agreed upon. And when the studio agrees upon it, you go ahead and make it. They had hired Michael Caine, who was going to be winning an Oscar that year for Hannah and Her Sisters, which a ceremony that, well, he couldn't attend because he was reshooting the ending to this film, which we will talk about. Oh, crazy indeed. Of course, they asked everybody to come back. Roy Scheider, duh. He's not going to be fucking coming back. They did ask Hooper. The Guzman did write a part for him in this. And of course, Dreyfuss was like, nah, no thanks. So what they ended up with was they had Lorraine Gary here. And they had a lot of the people from those first two films. If you notice, the mom of Alex Kittner is in a scene. And you have that broad who keeps telling Ellen that she's not an island person because she wasn't born here. The one with the big glasses. She's in this as well, in the immediate aftermath of Sean's death. But what they had written for Scheider, they had written him to be the one who dies in the beginning as opposed to Sean in the opening. Now, Adam, you and I have watched a lot of these movies where, you know, you bring these people back and they're killed off in the opening act. I mean, would it have been better with Scheider, or do you think it would have made a difference?
I think it would have been an absolute stunt, and I think it would have made Harrison Ford about as jealous as he could possibly be, because he's been trying to do that, get away with that shit for decades. I think it's the only way you would have got Schneider back, and I think both him and Dreyfuss, even back in the 80s, literally picked up their phone with new number, who dis, and wanted nothing to do with this film.
If you notice, too, they also just completely do away with the continuity of last week's film. They're like, Jaws 3 doesn't exist. You know, Mike was never an engineer. Although, it's weird, because if you look at the movie, they don't do anything to negate that. But Lorraine Gary's not in the third one, so, I mean, Matt, could this be looked at as in continuity, do you think?
I don't think so either, because there's no indication that Sean is taken over for his father as the sheriff in Jaws 3.
Yeah.
And also, there's never any mention of Mike going to, it's not the Bahamas in Jaws 3, but isn't it like Venezuela?
Venezuela, yeah.
So that's also dropped. I think this is a hard, I don't want to say, I will say it is a retcon.
One more thing I wanted to mention before we get into this amazing plot is there's a novelization associated with this movie. The novelization of this movie has different plot lines, two to mention, that are completely different than the movie that we're watching. I will mention them as we go, but before I get to it, Matt, are you familiar with what the novelization is?
Why would I waste my time doing anything associated with this movie beyond watching it out of obligation?
Okay, I'm going to talk about it as we get into the plot. It's going to blow your fucking mind. I'm just going to say that right now.
I mean, my mind is already kind of a puddle of goo having watched this for the first time in God knows how long.
Well, the good news was you didn't have to put out any more than 90 minutes for it because this thing doesn't go any more than an hour and a half.
No, it's like 85 minutes.
Yeah. All right. We open up with the Universal logo as we go underwater and then spring up for some opening credits. All right, guys, compliment alert. I really like what this composer, Michael Small, does with the score in this film. I think he takes these themes, and unlike last week's movie, which, God, that score was god-awful, this one does some pretty good things with the music in this.
Yeah, I really can't argue with that. It feels like it's ripping off John Williams better. So, that's, you know, including right here at the opening. I was like, well, they're not going to hold back the score this time. It's right up front, and I think it does a good job to open it. I also realized they give John Williams a different credit than he got last week, so that shit's just bonkers, you know, when you think about it. But yeah, I think the score is actually pretty complimentary.
So after the opening credits, we see a fish being fried as Sean is getting ready to go to work. There's a conversation that he's as sneaky as his father was, and he goes to his dad's old sheriff office. And we're hearing Thea call, and oh my God. All right, I'm not going to go into the story because it is downright depressing. But this little girl who plays Thea, she would go on to be in A Land Before Time. She would go on to be in All Dogs Go to Heaven. She lived to be 10 years old, and Lance Guest, mm-hmm. who plays Mike in this, was the pallbearer of her funeral. I'm not going to go into the story. If people are interested, Google it. I'm telling you right now, though, when you get them come out of it, you're not going to have anything but tears in your eyes. It is just sad, sad, sad. So hearing this little girl here, it really made me pause like, oh, that's right. This girl was in this movie. Are any of you guys familiar with that story?
Yeah, I was ahead of time, and I forgot how it ties into this, but I knew that story pretty well.
Man, and Lance Guest said in that interview I watched that, you know, her mom was on this set, and, like, she was nervous every minute of every day they were on this set. It's just sad. People, if you're interested, go check it out. Go read that story. So this is also when we hear Mike and how he has a job, quote, playing in the water all day, unquote. Now, if I hadn't read that Michael De Guzman was the writer of this, I would have thought it was Shane Black because, guys, we're in a Christmas movie this week.
And Adam, New Year's. It covers both of them.
Yeah. Adam, how shocked were you that we're in a fucking Christmas movie this week?
It's funny because you also took my note asking if Shane Black wrote this because it's also 1987.
Yes.
Jesus. It blew me away, but it also, by putting it in a specific time frame, I don't dislike that idea. I thought it was pretty charming, but I think it also helps get into the horror aspect because when you have something like this time of year. So yeah, I dug it. Though first, presumably a northeast, you know, little island town, there is a shocking lack of snow for it being the middle of December.
Yes. Good point.
Not only is there a surprising lack of snow, this is Amity Island, which is very, as we've come to establish in the first two movies, their commerce and their economy is driven through their beaches and the waterfront. So why the fuck do they have cows on this island? As we come to find out.
As I mentioned earlier, this is also the cameo of that broad who tells Ellen that she'll never be an Islander in the first film. She's here. And then we do get a Roy Scheider cameo, kind of, as we have this huge promo shot of Roy Scheider on the wall in this office.
I feel like this is like almost not a tribute, but kind of a middle finger for not being with the damn pack.
Probably.
It's so huge. So huge, they put it center frame. I love it.
So this office gets a call about a woodpile stuck in the middle of the fisherman's lane. The Coast Guard is working on something else, so it's going to be up to Sean to go take care of it. So the very next scene, we're seeing Christmas carolers rehearsing as Sean goes out in this yellow slicker to retrieve this pile of wood. He goes out in the water, and wouldn't you know it, there's a shark waiting for him. And this edited biting of the arm, oh my God, it's cut too fast to see anything that's going on. And this guy is doing a pretty piss-poor job of acting here. And just the fact that he falls in and is pulled under as the boat goes under at night. Right away, guys, I really did want to give this movie a shot, but I have to say, this is pretty inept.
If I would not have known any better, this would have been out of a 50s B-movie, right down to the ridiculous facial expressions and close-ups, not just of him, but the shark gets a lot of face time. And the editors also apparently, or whoever was working on this movie, they prematurely dumped Cherry Kool-Aid mix in the water before he even gets bitten. So the water is already blood red before the shark even makes contact. And secondly, they have so many cuts in this thing that it might as well be stitched together like thing from the Addams Family. And they also cut, his arm is supposed to be bitten off, but you can tell that A, there's no blood pouring out of it, and B, it's like he put his arm underneath the yes. giant coat because that's the only prop they could afford.
You can see his elbow right through the fucking slicker.
All right, it's shot at night and you can still see it.
Yeah.
Okay, one of the things that even I was taught out here in the California Delta is you don't take a boat out at night with just one person on it, no matter what kind of spotlight you have. So come on, Brody. I love this so much.
Oh my God.
This is, I can't, this movie, freaking 10 minutes in, lets me know that we are a schlock B-movie Jaws. Holy hell. Matt took my first note that for some reason, Jaws is going to emerge from an already bloody chummed up water and kind of cheese at the camera. I mean, this shark might as well be on TMZ, the FaceTime that it gets. It's just the cutting of this thing. Edward Scissorhands didn't cut this much. The quick cuts, I mean, this is slasher B-movie cut, and it doesn't end here with this. But, oh my God, I didn't expect it. It completely caught me off guard. Look, this is not the drama of Jaws. This is not the horrible remake of Jaws 2, and this isn't the attempt at distraction for Jaws 3. This thing is midnight movie fodder, and it lets me know that with this kill. And I can't believe this shark shows back up and finally gets Sean. Oh, the only thing that would have made this better is if Mama, or as I keep referring to her in this, if Grandma Brody got to watch this.
I gotta tell you guys, in the lead up to this movie, I was so excited as a near 10-year-old. I was watching all the makings of, which highlighted this scene. You know, I was watching all the trailers. The shot of Jake later when he tells Michael, we got a big fish down here. And Michael's like, oh yeah, how big? And the shark comes out of the water. That was played a lot. I was stoked. But when we rented this, when it had come out, and this scene comes on, right away I'm like, this is weird. This doesn't feel like what I was hoping for. So Ellen goes to see the body, and it's like she knows right away that this was a shark. We see her sobbing as Mike shows up with Thea, and is it safe to say, Adam, that this is one of the horniest women we've ever seen on screen? This Carla? I mean, this
one. Oh my God. From beginning to end, I mean, she tells her own mother-in-law later on.
We see Alex Kittner's mom somehow hanging around as Thea makes herself known, and Mike goes out to talk to his mom. He embraces her. I gotta tell you, Oedipus complex here, there's a lot of mom-son stuff going on here that is just really weird.
No, we're saving that for Sleepwalkers.
Okay, yes, couple years. Ellen tells Mike that the shark came for him, and it waited and came for him when the time was right. She tells him at dinner that she wants Mike out of the water and that she doesn't want him or anyone in her family anywhere near the water. Mike says that she can't believe that voodoo. That sharks do not commit murder. They don't pick out a person, and she brings up that his dad died of the fear of sharks. All right, so
where do we start?
I'll start right now by bringing up the novelization. Mike brings up voodoo here. In the novelization, there is a reason given as to why this shark is swimming from Amity Island to the Bahamas. Reason being is there is a voodoo priest by the name of Papa Jacques who is riding in the plane with Hoagie later on, Michael Caine's character, and he has a real disdain for Mike Brody. He has something against him. So for revenge, he sends this shark after this family. I don't know if the guy writing the novelization was doing his own thing or if that was an early script. There's even one point where Thea has like a psychic connection with the shark. It is truly bizarre. There's something else involving the Hoagie character that I'll bring up later. But Matt, could you imagine a voodoo shark?
I mean, anything is possible at this point. We have telepathic connections between a woman and a shark in this movie. Adding in a voodoo component would not have been all that much more absurd. It would have been stupid, and this movie jumps the shark so much that even Fonzie would be battling clinical depression because he got so outclassed.
Adam, is your mind blown right now? Voodoo sharks?
Yeah, I mean, you know what? I'm not surprised with the way that it goes. And yeah, I mean, we might as well, since we have that psychic connection, that link. You know what? That means that Ellen is the problem in this family. It's not the shark. Ellen is the problem. Kill her off, the shark goes away. I mean, sure, why not? I can't imagine what they were trying to do to get this thing greenlit. I'm not surprised there's a version where voodoo is in play.
All right.
So I thought Child's Play didn't come out until next year.
Yeah.
And you got to think about it. In the 80s, as soon as you talk about anything Bahamas related, you, of course, were throwing in some voodoo. We're not too far removed from James Bond going about as un-PC as they could with that.
And a year later, they would come out with The Serpent and the Rainbow, too. So you're right. Yeah, there's a lot of that going on. All right. Matt, did you have something to say about this Mike rant that goes on here?
So, yes, part B. Your father died of fear. The same guy who took down two sharks, no problem whatsoever. Okay. Kind of makes him look worse in hindsight.
Right?
Nah, it just seems like a weak sauce to get over it too quick. It's almost like they couldn't make a decision, so that's what they went with. Almost like you expect a reveal later on that there was something else, or maybe she was hiding information.
Maybe it was a Fatal Attraction thing where she just killed him because she was sick of his shit.
Yeah, she held his ass underwater because he wouldn't stop going out the damn boat.
Because my theory, this movie confirms she should be in a mental institution.
Yeah.
Yeah. Ellen killed Chief Brody. Calling it.
Unbelievable that you get pulled out of retirement for this script. It's just, it blows my mind.
At least she gets to be the lead, quote unquote.
Mike also says that they just got their first grant and that there has never been a great white in the Bahamas waters. We see Mike throwing rocks out of frustration, saying that it was, quote unquote, a shitty piece of wood. And we get some past stories about Sean as Mike just takes off running for some ungodly reason.
There's an arcade machine at the end of the beach. Greeting, Starfighter.
You text us during this movie like, holy shit, what is Lance Guest doing in this movie?
Oh my God. It took me a minute because he shows up and I'm like, man, that's the eyes are familiar, you know, but he's got the beard. And I'm like, Daryl Hall? No, this isn't Hall & Oates. I'm just like, what the? And then it hit and I'm like, oh my God. Greetings, Starfighter.
Oh. All I see is Jimmy from Halloween 2.
So we're seeing Sean's funeral as Ellen is laughing, thinking of past memories. Kind of inappropriate here. Mike invites Ellen to the islands with them. As both Thea and Carla agree, they say they're going out on the ferry today, which, by the way, this is the same ferry from the first Jaws movie.
This is when I do think, because, you know, there was a, does Jaws 3 count, or did they, you know, kind of reboot-a-quill this thing? You would think if Jaws 3 is in play, after the events of that film, there is not a single Brody family that should be anywhere near the water, including Mike going to the working on the frickin' Bahamas.
And also, it goes to show that they have no empathy for, you know, psychological trauma, because they don't go to Kansas like they should, where there's no water to be found and you're hundreds of miles from the beach. No, they go to the fucking Bahamas where you're surrounded by nothing but water.
The excuse that they give, it's too shallow for the sharks. We've been saying that every goddamn movie.
Mm-hmm. They get on the ferry as Ellen just loses it. And yeah, this is what grief does. It strikes you unexpectedly. So, I don't know. Again, I guess I'm giving another compliment here, but you never know when grief is going to take you over.
No, and she's putting way too much effort into a movie that's schlocky.
Very true. They get on a plane as Carla spots a parachute over the water. And they're on a plane being driven by good old Michael Caine. Now, famously, Michael Caine, he said that, you know, he's never seen the movie. By all accounts, it's terrible. But he does know the house that it built, and it's pretty damn tremendous. You can tell Michael Caine is pretty much sleepwalking through this movie.
Absolutely. I mean, they had him for all of reportedly 7 to 10 days, but still made her get top bill and paid him the $1.5 million. Though Michael Caine at this time, he would give an amazing performance. You know, look at something like Alfie. And then he would do just utter crap, you know, for a while to pay bills and pay taxes. So he is one of the he might as well be Batman, because he's got two sides to his acting, and not just his ability, but the effort he puts out. Hey, a few years later, we get him in his absolute frickin' best performance in history as Ebenezer Scrooge. So we're only a few years removed from Muppet's Christmas Carol, before Muppet's Christmas Carol. But he brings a presence to this film that almost nobody else does.
Well, he's also not above this kind of material, because let's not forget, he made The Swarm 10 years before this.
And On Deadly Ground 7 years later.
Or he did the sequel to The Poseidon Adventure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So there was precedent for him doing these kind of schlocky type of genre films. And you would have stuff interchanged, like Dressed to Kill, which I really like. You know, Hannah and her sisters. But yeah, this kind of kicked off a period where, you know, he'd make a couple good things. Like, right after this, he makes 30 Rotten Scoundrels, which is great. And then, turd, Muppet Christmas Carol. Like, you keep doing that for the rest of his career. It's appropriate, though, his character's named Hoagie, because holy shit, this movie has a ton of ham in it.
God damn it, you did not just... I had that for half an hour down the road.
Yeah, it's so funny. He said that one of the first drafts, it wasn't in the Bahamas, it took place in Hawaii. And the script page said, cut to Hawaii. He accepted it right after that. He took scripts to also go on vacation. I don't want to spend a bunch of time in cold weather. Oh, we're going to Hawaii? Yeah, let me go to Hawaii.
I heard that was one of the reasons he agreed to it.
Amazing.
Was he was getting a paid vacation to Hawaii.
That was Adam Sandler's whole thing for like a decade.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know what?
Or Adam Sandler is, I'm going on vacation and I'm hiring the hottest women in Hollywood to play my wife.
I love actors who are, they don't give a fuck. They will just let loose exactly what they were thinking instead of hiding behind it. This guy's won an Oscar and he's fucking talking like that. I love Michael Caine for that reason.
And something wonderful when you can get the British to be honest about it.
Right.
Now, well, they are. Maybe Muppets have that in common because he's basically Tim Curry in that regard.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is another character. It's different in the book. Later on in the movie, Jake and Mike ask him, so what do you do when you're not flying planes? And Hoagie says, I deliver laundry. Well, in the book, he's a drug smuggler. They change that around, which I guess you do that because you want to make him quote-unquote likable. You don't want him to have that kind of background, but that's what they did, and I'm kind of glad they cut that out.
I got that impression, though. When he mentioned, you know, doing laundry or shipping laundry, I had the impression he was smuggling or helping people literally launder money is what I took that as. Mm-hmm. So I took that he was using this plane for nefarious purposes.
Yeah, I thought he was, like, driving or flying across the border.
Well, speaking of using this plane for nefarious purposes, he's fucking with everybody by flying all around and turning his plane into a roller coaster, pretty much. So then they get in a taxi, and it's being driven by a Christmas caroler. This was kind of adorable, where Thea asked him to sing Christmas carols, and he's singing to them on their way. And they pull up.
No, I'm saving that for the Muppets.
They pull up, and Ellen is already tripping over Thea being on a swing that swings over the water. She says that she feels like a grandma as Mike shows her around the place. By the way, you are a grandma. We see this new piece of art that Carla has made called Tourist on the Loose, and all Ellen sees is a shark, apparently.
Yeah, it's literally shark jaws.
Unbelievable. They do nothing.
Like, are you trying to have this woman kill herself?
I know! We cut to a nightmare of Ellen swimming and then getting attacked by a shark.
Oh, I hate this trope every fucking time they do it. The dream sequences that turn out to be exactly that. Let's at least have Freddy Krueger voice the shark. Hell, I'm pretty sure the shark is the one who called Sean's secretary and said, go check out the driftwood.
Well, the next year, Freddy would be imitating Jaws in a movie.
That's right.
In Nightmare 4. I remember this scene being in a few of the trailers, so it misled you into thinking that she was going to get, you know, she was going to get it, pretty much. She's swimming and then getting attacked by a shark. It's a good ordeal, but again, the fast cuts. I haven't seen this many fast cuts since I watched a fucking Bourne movie.
Yeah, and like I didn't understand it was a dream at first, you know, because my note is, why the hell would she be out swimming? So it, you know, it completely contradicts, and then I'm just like, oh my God, you did not just give me a fucking dream. You know, it's almost insulting at that. I hate the trope of doing this.
Well, that's the tell, it's a hallucination that she's in the water by herself. The Brody family does not understand the buddy system whatsoever.
All right. Well, speaking of offensive, so she wakes up and we cut to Mike and Jake. Jake being played by Mario Van Peebles, man. Now, Mario Van Peebles, this is interesting. We talked about the first film. Shaw gave that tremendous speech. At least me and Matt thought it was a tremendous speech about the Indianapolis. The movie they made with Nicolas Cage was directed by Mario Van Peebles. Based on the Indianapolis. So he has some ties to Jaws. He's the one who brought the accent. He's the one who wanted to do this. His father has a cameo later as, I think, the mayor of the Bahamas, presents an award to Carla later. But man, Mario Van Peebles, this is an odd part.
And his accent, he goes from Sebastian the Crab to... He goes from Sebastian the Crab to Pookie from New Jack City. He might as well, like, there's no, and everything in between. It is laughable how that accent comes and goes more than the shark does.
You know, I didn't think I'd ever see something more offensive than his performance in Highlander 3, but this might take the cake.
Oh my God. I forgot about that one.
I mean, it's so, if he was from Bahamas, he's Mexican. Okay, being a Mexican doesn't make you Bohemian. It is a fucking different part of the because he can tan, I guess they try to determine that it's okay. Like, that's pretty fucked up. I'm sorry, it is. Is he fun? He is. Is he offensive? Oh God, yeah. But Matt kind of nailed it. He's Sebastian the Crab. This thing, Mike, the surface world is a mess.
And Highlander 3 has a lot in common with this movie because they both basically contradict and or retcon the previous movie. Maybe it's like Highlander 3 where it's a separate timeline.
Maybe. Mike's deep diving for some shell animals, and they get into an argument over what they're really out here to do. This was a dynamic I found odd. Is Jake supposed to be Mike's boss? Are they just...
like it's his college roommate.
I couldn't get a gist on that.
I feel like they both need to be wearing whatever college sweater they went to at least identify how these two know each other.
Great point.
You know, that's why Sigourney Weaver wears Stanford.
Yes.
Everything that she does. You know, these guys need a University of Miami to show that they went to college and they're fucking... See, science, I mean, it's so ill-defined.
Well, speaking of ill-defined, that defines this argument, because they go at each other, and then Jake just pauses, just like, sorry about your brother, man, and then picks him up and trolls him, and then it's like everything's okay again. I don't know, just weird.
Yeah, if it was somebody we knew previously, but I do get that these two have a relationship.
We cut to a Christmas dinner as Ellen shares stories about Sean and Mike, and Jake and his wife are there too. Ellen helps herself outside as Mike follows her out, and they both say that they miss Sean, but Ellen isn't getting off the "you need to stop working underwater" train. Mike reassures her that what he does is perfectly safe.
He should also be like, okay, why don't you sell your house and move to the middle of nowhere? Like you're the one who's all stressed out, not me.
We then cut to underwater as the shark approaches the camera and roars as it swims past. Oh my lord, guys. This is one of the most bizarre series. We have regressed each and every film. This is a god-awful shark. It almost looks like it's made out of felt.
Damn it. All right, well, you prepped one of my notes. I rewound it twice to make sure that I heard a roar, because I didn't know if it was some other kind of sound effect. And I'm like, is that just supposed to be, you know, the wave crashing? No, it's a roar coming from this shark. And to the fact that you say that this thing looked like it's made of felt, there are clear shots later on in this film when you get towards behind the shark and its top dorsal fin, you can see that it's stitched. And you can see the stitches on the shark.
Matt. Also, it bites onto stuff so that it doesn't tip over like a cow. It's like the Christopher Reeve Superman films where the effects get worse and worse with each movie. To the point, I mean, this is like Quest for Peace level of horrendous special effects. I mean, this puts the special in special effects.
Well, it's so inept, guys, that later on when we have shots of these boats in this water, you can see water hit the backdrop that is painted on. It is so inept. And then we cut from there to Ellen helping Thea build a sandcastle, and then Stan to look at, as it looks like she has a psychic connection with the shark. We've gone to bonkers town, guys.
This is some Stephen King shit.
Yeah, I was thinking the same thing.
Are there speakers playing music out of the water? Because it seems like she hears the theme and then is like, ooh, where'd it come from?
No, it's like she touches the water and that triggers their psychic connection.
Oh my God, yeah.
It's like an electrical conduit.
Why is it as soon as any Brody steps in the water, it like activates the shark?
We cut to Hoagie rowing in, and I want to go ahead and give another compliment, guys. I think the developing relationship between Hoagie and Ellen is rather sweet. Now, I'm sure there was something in Gary's contract that says she would have a love interest, so it feels like an obligation, but I think having two middle-aged actors, having these two having this great chemistry, it's unusual seeing this happen in a Hollywood movie, and I thought this was rather sweet.
Yes, it is, but it also does not feel consistent with the overall tone of the movie. Like, this honestly feels like something you would see in a Woody Allen movie, where you have like two people, one widowed, one's kind of a cad, trying to hook up and see if they can develop something because they haven't dated for so long. But it's in a movie where a woman has a psychic connection with a shark that has a Charles Bronson death wish level of vengeance.
This was around the time Death Wish 3 was coming out.
It does feel like she's like, this movie is kind of doing what Diane Keaton had made half of her career on. But I do like the relationship with these two. And you know what? Good for Lorraine Gary. If I'm coming out of retirement, I want to kiss Michael Caine.
There you go.
Good for her. I'd like these two together. Look, I'm not going to bash Lorraine Gary. I'm actually kind of digging what she's doing, as stupid as the script is, and I smile when Michael Caine shows up.
We cut to Mike, Jake, and their Bahamas-bred drummer as they're going over some of their findings. They say they have 3 months of work, so why not spend it on beer, as they say? Jake suggests going into naval research. He says it's getting on his nerves not having any money doing what they do, and Mike is distracted by seeing Hoagie trying to pimp his mom. Speaking of which, Ellen is convinced that Sean's death wasn't an accident. She knows that it's come for them as the tide is coming in. Oh boy, guys. We cut to Hoagie showing Ellen how to fly, or at least forcing her to, before they crash into the water. Hoagie says it is like driving a car, and this is when he mentions flying supplies, aka drugs.
if you look out the window, like, they're supposed to be flying up in the sky, and it seems like the freaking the beach is literally just outside the window. Like, you can see the shore. Yeah. The height level makes no sense to me on this plane, which now, I guess makes sense as they crash it.
Now, Adam, you've heard about the notoriousness of this movie. I think we're about 35, 40 minutes in. How are you feeling at this point? Are you thinking it's as bad as its reputation?
It is as bad as its reputation, comma, I am having more fun than I had the last 2 weeks.
Wow. Even more fun than last week.
Yeah, and I didn't mind last week, but I'm having fun watching what's going on. And I think the absurdness of the way that Sean is killed at the beginning kind of sets a tone that I know we are in B-movie schlock. And by setting that up early, I'm just fucking laughing at the moments I need to laugh at and rolling my eyes in a good way. Like, I wish I had more beers in front of me taking drinks or taking shots every time that Lorraine Gary looks out at the water, but goddamn, I'm having way more fun than I expected. This is a midnight movie. This is absolutely a midnight movie.
Now, Matt, you also were known of its reputation before you watched the movie initially. It had been out a number of years before you finally got around to it. How are you feeling at this point? Are you thinking it's as bad as it's reputed to be?
Yes, but I'm in agreement with Adam. This is the kind of bad movie I enjoy watching because it's so, I mean, absurd is being a tremendous understatement. This thing goes so far down the road of just ridiculousness that you can't look at it as anything other than camp. But the problem also, it's like Batman and Robin in this sense. Batman and Robin has the Alfred subplot, which is played like legitimate drama, but it acts as a reprieve from how obnoxious the rest of the movie is. That's how I feel about the scenes with Lorraine Gary and Michael Caine. It's like we're trying to take a break from the stupidity, but by doing so, it feels like you're watching an entirely separate movie. So I think they have that in common. But I'm having a lot more fun with this movie, ironic or not, compared to the previous two.
That's a great comparison, actually. I didn't think about that, but you're right. I remember that the McGregor syndrome plot point, and these two getting together, it's more believable than that subplot. We cut to a Bahamas party, and man, do these look fun. And again, Hoagie and Ellen are just adorable in this. We cut to Mike in the boat busting Jake's boondi as the drummer has his feet in the water, but Jake is distracted as a shark swims right by him. Jake says, "There's a big fish down here, man." And when Mike asks how big, the shark rises out of the water, terribly fake jaws and all, and Ellen apparently has to shine because she stops having a hell of a good time and is looking out like she senses that the shark is attacking. It comes up and starts eating their boat before going back under. So it's eating this boat like it's a fucking $5 foot long. And Matt, you're absolutely right. The only reason they do shit like this is so that it doesn't fall right on its fucking back as they operate the mechanics of it.
Well, I will also say that the one thing it does have in common with Jaws 3 as far as continuity, this is the second movie where they have a fucking submarine, but they still have to wear scuba gear inside the submarine.
Thank you. I've been to the Bahamas a number of times, and you can see it very clearly in this film. This is the most clear, pristine water that you will ever see. That you can't see this thing coming 2 miles out of shore is utterly ridiculous. This is an Amity Island. When Michael Caine's on a boat later, you can see the bottom of the reefs. That shark just appears like it's freaking Freddy Krueger popping out of a mirror.
Well, this movie also has the problem that some of these type of films do, where the creature, the titular creature or the antagonist, can seemingly teleport at random, because that displacement is a huge problem with this movie. Also, the fact that the shark followed them all the way from Martha's Vineyard to the Bahamas
in less than 2 days.
In less than 2 days. And also, the shark brings the driftwood with it. It is this thing uses the driftwood, its calling card, like when you see Sting with a bat.
Yeah, kind of surprised at that point it doesn't just spit up Sean's arm, be like, "Hey, remember me?" But it's watching the shark when it's underwater. Did the tail not work? Because it's kind of just floating and pushes along like a little kid does a submarine in the bathtub. It's not moving. It's just moving through the screen.
Hoagie suggests to Ellen giving life a kick in the ass, and then we cut back to Mike and Jake, and Jake's wondering why the shark didn't come for him. It focused on Mike instead, and Mike is adamant about not saying anything about this to his mom. Mike is then seen looking out in the ocean as we cut to Hoagie dropping Ellen off. Mike is at the window watching Hoagie drop her off, and only a pair of flicked panties tears him from the damn window.
But this is also weird because now that they're trying to do the thing where, like, the son is upset about his mom.
I hate this. That's one thing about this movie I hate. Yeah.
Yeah, I thought it was going to be a problem. I thought it was going to be a fight. And it's not, so I don't know why you include it, other than you didn't have a lot to cut if you were going to hit the runtime of this movie, because it's brisk. This movie goes faster than, well, maybe not as fast as Jark swims, since it has to get down to the Bahamas as fast as a plane, but this movie, it runs quick.
Well, also one of the problems is that they never say how long Martin's been dead for.
Right.
Weird cut to... As what? Mike leaves... The
living hell.
Mike leaves...
Sorry. The filmmakers knew very few things about the Bahamas, and they threw all of them in. They went there once on a cruise in the 80s.
Yeah.
And they, because I've been in these street fairs. It's kind of weird how offensive they get it in this film. They have a couple casinos, and they got a couple art galleries that they always have, especially metalworking. But they're usually not done by seaside white women that are deciding that they're going to infiltrate the Bahamas, man. But they had very few things, and they're like, put them all in. This casino, what the shit?
Mike leaves to get a table, and Hoagie is doing some massive betting, and he loses at craps. I do like this line, as Ellen says, I suppose that's bad. And Hoagie just says, depends on your point of view.
Depends on if the point is put out there or not.
Yeah, exactly.
I can win.
This is also why you kept making shitty movies.
Very true. We're getting toast to happy birthdays and a happy new year, and Jake keeps this secret of this shark all of about 5 hours before almost giving it up right here at the table of this shark. Hoagie and Ellen dance to... The Jets! Adam, remember these guys? I had their tape. The Jets!
No.
Yes. Oh my gosh, straight from the fucking 80s. Yes, I had this tape. I got it for Christmas that year. Mike is just distracted and jealous of Hoagie and his mom, and he cuts right in. As Mike dances with her, he says that he doesn't like Hoagie chasing after her. And here's the thing, if they had continued the storyline of him being a drug runner, I could buy this. But as it is in this movie, I just can't, because Hoagie's doing nothing wrong here.
Yeah, I'm like, why are you being so covetous?
Yeah.
Like, is this Game of Thrones where we're going to have, like, incest?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I can't say that I haven't known an overprotective son when the mom starts dating somebody new. I can't say that I haven't
All right, well, somebody. Moving on. So, Ellen... Ellen then tells Mike that she's going to stop bothering him about his work, and she refuses to let obsession take her over. We cut
for
to
all of 5 minutes.
Yeah, we cut to the next day as Mike shows up, and there's no Clarence or William, and Jake is working on tools that'll help them study the shark. How is he this smart that he gets these fucking tools? I don't know.
Because he worked at SeaWorld.
Oh,
like okay. That thing of like maybe it is canon because he knows how to work, you know, some engineering equipment, which is what he did at SeaWorld.
Oh, this is Jake, though, that I'm talking about.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah, it's weird.
Yeah. Doesn't he say he's an engineer?
He does, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, it's amazing, though, because how many times in the span of two retrospectives are we going to discuss a freaking transmitter getting attached to an animal?
I was getting there. So Jake says that they're going to go after the shark, and Mike says that they have 5 months' work left on the grant that they have, and Jake is just obsessed with studying this, the first great white to be discovered at the Bahamas. Mike throws his stuff on another boat, and Jake does some huge convincing as he says that they'll go back to the snails after they study the shark for just a few days. We cut to Carla and Mike. They get into a fight about Mike being very distracted lately. Lord knows I've been yelled at for not taking out the garbage. This is too real for me.
What the fuck? So this is going on, and I dozed out for about 15 seconds, and I'm like, what are they yelling at each other for with the garbage? Did I miss? Back it up a few. Nope, she's just yelling at him for not taking out the garbage. But yep, I've been there
many times.
Yeah, I don't like how this movie turns into a documentary for this part. But also, he should be like, okay, you're home all day.
Yeah.
No, folks, do not use that line.
It's like telling a woman to calm down.
It's because they act like their mother.
Should be said, I haven't had this fight since I've been with my current lovely fiance, but I've had these fights in the past. But I guarantee, guys, this is yet another fight that'll get solved with sex later. This chick is just sexed up.
Oh yeah, this is like in the room.
Yeah. Mike still refuses to talk about what's wrong, and she pulls out a welding tool. Oh boy.
I had never seen this movie, so my note is, I can't believe they just showed us Chekhov's welding torch. Because obviously that's what they bring this thing out the same way they bring out how they've killed Jaws in the last three movies. So I got no doubt this is going to be used.
Well, they also do the Jaws. It might as well be a 3D because she points it at the camera. It might as well shoot the flames at your face.
Yeah. I guess seawater maybe is his code word.
We then cut to the reddest chum I've ever seen as they lower some meat to bring the shark in. Jake goes out on a skiff a little bit as the shark approaches, and boy oh boy, again, even from this distance, the shark just looks so fucking fake.
I don't mind the mouth of it, but there is something that just looks off to the entire shark.
They lower the meat in, and the shark takes it, and Jake hits him with the tracking device. Mike can't stop looking at the water as we cut to Hoagie and Ellen getting to know each other a little more. And goddamn, I want a Bahama Mama. That drink just sounds delicious.
They are stupendous.
Oh.
I mean, it's no Blue Hawaiian, but
maybe that'll
you happen. You have to make it right, though, because if you use the pre-made mix, it tastes way too sweet.
Yep.
Guys, we got to go then. So Hoagie offers to take Ellen on an excursion and then says that he has the urge to kiss her. He says that his vision is perfect as he goes in for a kiss. We go back on the boat as Jake urges the overgrown goldfish to come to Uncle Jake, and Mike asks about Hoagie. In all this, the shark just disappears from Jake's radar.
Okay, you're tracking it by sound. It can't turn, unless it's, you know, maybe its heart doesn't work. Maybe it's a mythical shark that it's so cold-blooded it shuts its heart off. Like, you're tracking its movement through sound, through sound waves.
Well, they're treating the shark like it's a whale that moves through sonar.
Mm-hmm.
More shots of this shark swimming, or I guess that's what it's doing.
It's floating. It is like floating from right to left.
This is the equivalent of Buzz Lightyear saying, it's not flying, this is falling with style. This is the swimming equivalent. It's floating in style.
To be expanded upon next year. We see Ellen acting like a schoolgirl as she tells Carla all about Hoagie. Carla says that she's counting on having a long, happy sex life. Jesus Christ.
So, I mean, of all the things you say to your mother-in-law, it's not...
Well, she's like, I know she's not moving in with us, so I can say whatever the fuck I want.
Well, this chick playing Carla, she ended up marrying Tom Noonan a few years later. So we know where her tastes lie.
There's a lot of coincidence because both Mario Van Peebles and Tom Noonan played characters named Kane.
Oh, good point. We cut to Mike having nightmares about the shark, and he tells Carla that it's just a stupid dream.
So now the shark is literally Freddy Krueger, where it's invading all of the Brody family dreams.
We then see a rehash of the Martin Sean scene from the first film.
Oh, this is shameless.
My very next question was, Matt, is this too much?
I rest my case, Your Honor.
Okay.
I found it an adorable nod to that first film.
I'm with you.
Thank you. God. This is so fucking saccharine. I feel like it off Spielberg's ass cheeks.
This is brought to you by the Sweetums Candy Corporation. Without a doubt.
Ellen calls out what Mike was doing, and Ellen also calls out that Mike seems unhappy and she's worried about him. She says it's
his turn. He's getting late every night.
Right? She says it's his turn to work on his smile. We cut to Jake giving...
To which Shawn Michaels said.
I know.
And go find my
10
smile.
Years later, Shawn Michaels would go with that.
This movie probably was made as much cocaine as the Rockers went through in the AWA.
We cut to Jake, who somehow has the Jaws theme in his head. We're hearing that this is going to be a half and half day. Half a day on the snails and half a day on the shark. Jake says that he has a 3-mile radius on the monitor as the radar starts going off. He tells Mike to get out of the water, and we get another sub chase, guys. The only reason this one doesn't look worse than last week's is because it's not in 3D.
Also, I mean, these movies use so much of the yellow submarine iconography. I half expect the shark to look like a blue beanie.
Mike's... Bravo. You know what I can't... Okay, when you look at this scene, though, and Mike escapes and goes into this boat that's under the... This is Finding Nemo. Like, this is what they do to escape from Bruce the Shark and Bruce Break. Obviously, Bruce is from Jaws. They recreate this is the scene in Finding Nemo. And I could not believe that.
It's been so long since I watched Finding Nemo. I don't remember that, but now I've got to watch it, see if that's right. Mike's sub is getting destroyed as Jake is having a hard time getting a hold of him. Mike gets out of the sub and is getting chased underwater. Oh my God, this shot of the shark with its mouth open to the camera. Jesus Christ.
Seems like so often they could not get the jaws to move because it's just going to, well, I guess we'll find out later. It's going to swallow you whole.
Mike goes in some sort of underwater structure. Maybe it's a sunken boat as we see it swim from a below shot.
Swim in quotes.
Yeah. All right. So Adam, I'm going to go to you because you're the scuba swimmer here. Or former scuba swimmer. So the way Mike gets out of this, he takes his tank off and spurts himself to the surface. This is preposterous, right?
Did anybody ever watch The Abyss? I mean, even if you're, by the time you're lower than 10 feet, and he seems to be down 20, 30 feet, and he's been down there for over half an hour, let's assume, He's bending as he comes up. He would be in agony, if not crippled. You can't do this. And if you were going to do it, dropping your weights, which it always bugs me when I see scuba divers and I don't see any weights mounted on them, because you have to have those to dive. Dropping your weights, you could also just rocket up to the surface, but you would be crippled.
Yeah, this is the one thing that Jaws 2 actually does better, is the diver has the bends and that contrives them going back to get medical attention. This movie, he might as well be Superman. I will say, though, this is less absurd than how Ethan Hunt gets out of that fucking submarine in the last Mission Impossible movie.
Well, no shit.
Mike continues looking out into the water, and we see him laying in bed with a bandage on his arm, still distracted as he looks at himself in the mirror. It's weird, you know, this was advertised as an Ellen movie, but Adam, it's more of a Mike movie at this point, isn't it? We're getting a lot of him here.
It's shifting. And it's not a surprise. You're not going to sell this movie. I hate to say it. You're not going to sell this movie on an older female lead. Mm-hmm. You're not, sadly. That's Hollywood. I do appreciate how much Ellen we have in this film. But yeah, it's Mike's movie, especially when he's the last male heir of the Jaws tragedy. Fuck, I said that sentence.
You did.
Yeah. The shark keeps attacking this family like it's an opposing mafia family. Keeps doing hits.
We cut to Mike back in diving gear, and even though it's Jake's turn to go underwater, Mike just responds that he's scared shitless, but what is he supposed to do? So he goes back in, and Jake is again not getting anything on the shark monitor. Jake says maybe the shark just likes white meat. Mike is attacked. Adam's laughing. Jesus Christ.
Hey, as racist as the Bohemian stuff is in this, it's perfectly acceptable to throw it the other way, finally.
Yeah, were you laughing at this, though, as Mike is attacked by an eel?
Yes, because I love cheap jump scares.
Oh, does that mean we're doing The Conjuring next? Oh, no. Nope. We cut to Carla's art ceremony, which Jake and Mike are absent from. Thea wants to go on the banana boat. And let me tell you guys, this was another scene. It was used to sell this movie in the marketing. I was ecstatic after seeing glimpses of this. Ellen positions herself to see the banana boat, as it doesn't take long for the shark to make itself known. It approaches the boat, and all the women are yelling to get her out. And the shark doesn't take Thea, it takes the girl who was next to her, right under.
Yeah, because the shark must go by movement because it clearly can't see. And this shot is so bad. This is Shark Attack 3 Megalodon level of schlocky effects. I half expected someone to get on a jet ski and run into the shark's mouth.
I was glad to finally see some, you know, shark kills again. This is pretty brutal. It's effective. I think it works pretty damn well. I got to laugh at this point of the Kool-Aid overness of the red and the way that they're doing it, but it's better than having an exploding fountain coming up from the water like we've had in previous Jaws films. I dig this. I could use a little more.
Wow. You just said this was better than the Alex Kittner kid in the first film?
No. But as ridiculous as it seems to have this level of Kool-Aid looking blood, I got to remember what's come before this. But no, I dig this kill a lot.
All right. So they rescue the rest of the girls, and Ellen looks out at the shark and goes on her own personal mission. Because guys, as the marketing says, this time it's personal.
Well, my theory, because I'm gonna attempt to do psychoanalysis on a movie about psychic sharks. She's going out there to commit suicide and end the curse.
That's what I thought too.
Oh yeah, that's exactly what I took it. That if she dies, the attack on the families will end with her. Yep.
So Mike shows up, and Carla asks where he's been. She tells him that Thea was attacked by the shark, and as soon as Mike says, "I should have known," he gives away the fact that he'd known about the shark the entire time.
He also should have not been a douchebag husband and been there for his wife's art gallery or art presentation.
No shit. When the focus turns on his mother, nobody answers, and Mike knows right away. He runs to Jake, and Carla is just screaming at him as he leaves. They find Hoagie on a motorboat, and they get on Hoagie's plane. Hoagie says that the shark will find her and that she believes it's the same one that's killed the rest of her family. And this is when he delivers laundry line, comes out. They find a few boats, but no Ellen. Speaking of Ellen, we see her on the boat as the shark approaches, and they see from the air Mike's boat and the shark coming after it. Ellen tells the shark to come get her, which I think that's kind of taken from the first Jaws, where he says, "Smile, you son of a..." I think this is like, "Come get me," kind of thing. And Hoagie says, "Is that what I think it is?" Again, the Michael Caine acting here. Just so funny.
Yeah, the character named Hoagie should also not have a plane. He should have a submarine.
Nice recovery, sir. Nice recovery from Adam taking
a joke. I'm 2-0 on sandwich puns.
Very well done. He flies down as Mr. McSharky in all of its rubber glory kind of jumps and kind of lunges after Ellen. So I'm guessing, here's what I'm guessing, guys. Did the propeller hit the shark and that's why the plane just goes down?
As it's coming in to land, you see one of the propellers break off in the water. It's not a seaplane. So, but as he's landing it on the water, you see what the left, I can't believe I, for some reason I remember this in my mind, you see the left propeller shear off.
Wow. You were really paying attention. Hoagie calls for some rescue boats as well as someone who can kill a huge shark as he lands the plane. These guys never show up. Mike and Jake, they jump in the water, but Sharky comes after Hoagie. Ellen asks Mike, why did he come out here? And she says that she had to take the boat as there was nothing else they could have done.
And obviously he was hungry because its stomach was roaring before it had a hoagie for lunch.
Well, apparently he spits them out like bad Chinese food.
Well, Hoagie comes out of the water fully dry.
Yes. This movie is also great with if you like continuity, this movie tells you don't expect it.
Yeah.
Because they don't even try. This is the opposite of Mark Hamill talking about his hair being wet in Star Wars with the trash compactor. Uh-huh. And Harrison Ford looking at him and going, hey, kid, it ain't that kind of movie.
If you watch the Siskel and Ebert review of this, they point this out. It's so funny. Jake gets his equipment back up and going. He says that the shark is close as we hear the heartbeat. They hook the radio to the strobe, and Jake says that if it attacks again, he's going to give it a meal he will never forget. Jake says
he's not lying.
He's not. Although maybe he wasn't. We'll talk about that later. Jake says that they don't care what they eat. As Hoagie says, well, of course he doesn't care about digestion because you already ate my plane. I remember my dad laughing hysterically at that line when we were watching this.
But he did take down the plane.
Yes.
Yeah, like these sharks are very good at taking down planes because it does the same thing with a helicopter in Jaws 2.
It does, yeah.
Yeah.
The heartbeat stops. And Jake is convinced that his equipment did not crap out. And Hoagie says maybe he had a heart attack. The shark comes back as Hoagie tells Ellen to start the engine. Jake goes out on the bow. And in another wonderful effect, the shark pulls Jake off the skiff and pulls him under. There's absolutely no chance he survives this. Right, guys?
I know which cut I watched because I didn't know it was cut two different ways.
Yep.
This is done so poorly because I don't know how they decided to edit this, but Jake's there. There's a quick cut, and then suddenly he's getting pulled underwater. It doesn't line up. And then when he's pulled underneath, the amazing thing is apparently they used some kind of... Remember those old toys that would change color when you put them in water? Because Jake is a different color when he just decides to get submerged.
Jake is a pool of blood, and Mike just yells, Jake's name, in slow motion. Hoagie says that they're taking on too much water as Mike emerges with Jake's new charging toy. All right, boys, let's go over this climactic set of scenes. So first, we have Ellen, who is having flashbacks to events she was nowhere near.
She's psychic.
Yeah, now she's like the Dream Master, where she acquires everyone else's like powers.
How inept is this bullshit of her flashing back to when Brody killed the first shark? Second, we have Mike, who is playing with Jake.
This might as well have turned into like the end of Star Wars with Luke on the trench run, and he hears Obi-Wan's voice.
Yeah.
He might as well have had voice Shiner like stand behind her like a force ghost.
Second, we have Mike, who is playing with Jake's new toy and firing off chargers. We have Hoagie.
Flashlight tag.
We have Hoagie, who is mighty concerned about the boat, and Ellen is having to shoo him away as she continues to drive the boat toward the shark. And we have good old Sharky himself. As Mike is firing the charges, the shark emerges from the water, roaring like the MGM lion.
Yeah, sharks don't make that kind of growl. No,
it wasn't worth it to do it just once or twice earlier. This shark repeatedly fucking growls as it's quote-unquote swimming toward the boat.
This isn't all. During one of these massive charges, the shark is lingering out of the water like a dolphin during a SeaWorld show, and Ellen has precise boat driving skills and punctures the shark with the boat, making it explode!
Yeah, apparently all the sharks in this movie ate 10 sticks of dynamite as their last meal before fighting the Brodies.
Maybe it did have a heart attack and it was taking its nitroglycerin. Oh my god,
this I can't isn't believe all, the though.
Shark... It gets pierced and explodes like a freaking balloon!
Well, what's weird about this is this wasn't the original ending.
No.
The original ending was, A, Jake is dead. He's not coming back. They never have him emerge saying, it must not look like Dark Meat, or whatever the hell he says as he comes out of the water. And B, it doesn't explode like a goddamn dynamite stick. I think they wanted to harken back to Peter Benchley's novel, where it just punctured it, and the shark just kind of falls to its death in the water. So, man, it's just really bizarre, guys. I remember the rental copy I had when I initially watched this was the one where he's dead. But then I remember when I watched it on cable, he comes back. I'm like, wait a second here. Like... I think this was the first time as a kid where I was like, I watched two different versions of the movie and I didn't, and I was like totally confused.
You know what it's got this weird broke, I don't even remember the front being broken off where it would look like it's got the, I don't know, like you see on pirate ships, just this front of it. But you also could have just literally run the shark through, brought the bow of the ship up and had it just sever this thing. Well, I guess you gotta maybe not sever the shark in half like it's Art the Clown, but the explosion is such a weird go.
Poorly shot, poorly edited, I mean
but it I gotta say though, but that kind of makes it fit.
Hoagie and Ellen, they both fall in as the rest of the shark does a nosedive, similar to how Spielberg showed it in the first film. Yes, I just compared a scene in this to the first Jaws. So as they gather all their senses after the explosion, we have the most unbelievable part of the film. Jake survives.
But he got his color back.
According to test audiences, they wanted Jake to survive, so they recut this ending. Yeah, because that's the one that saved the movie.
Finally, the black man lives.
We get Ellen getting on the plane with Hoagie as she tells Mike goodbye, as well as take care of Jake. Boy, some ADR, I guess.
It says, get the fuck out of the water.
As credits roll on an amazing Jaws the Revenge. All right, boys, scale of 1 to 10. What do we give this final movie of this series? Adam, as a first-time viewer, you go ahead, sir.
All the movies that have come after Jaws, and I don't mean the Jaws proper, but all of the ripoffs, all of the spoofs, all of the pseudo sequels that you get, like Deep Blue Sea, The Meg, so many other things. This might be the best fake Jaws sequel, and it's a Jaws sequel. This thing is ridiculous from credit to credit. The opening score that they actually bring back so much, to go into the Bahamas, to assuming a shark is going to pace a jet flying from frickin' New England down to fucking South America. I mean, this is the most ridiculous concept of a movie that stars a shark that I think I have seen. And I freaking adore how unabashedly cheesy and crazy and stupid this movie is. You can't take it yourself too seriously at this point, and they don't. You know, they didn't write a serious script that's done poorly. They write a cheesy script that's done with cheese, and I think it's because of that that I had way more fun than I ever expected to have. This is a movie I think you can enjoy with friends. You can make it a drinking game, and it's 90 minutes. You're in and out. Part of the problem with 2 and 3 is just extending itself beyond the plot that it had. Lorraine Gary, Michael Caine, Mario Van Peebles. I mean, this is Lance Guest. This is just crazy in the absolute best way. Is it a good movie? Hell no. But Cheese Whiz isn't good, and sometimes I want it on a Ritz for a snack. And this is kind of the snack that I wanted, because I feel like it's the palate cleanser at the end of this retrospective. I'm giving this a 5. And I know how ridiculous that is, and I don't care, because I had so much fun with this. 5 on 10.
Man, I thought with the way you were building that up, you're going to go 7, because you gave last week's movie a 6. Thank you.
Did I?
Yeah.
Okay, you know what? I can't go lower then. I'm giving this a 6, because right. I can't put this under 3.
Wow, 6 out of 10 for Jaws Revenge from Adam. Matt, bring this back to Earth, will you?
No, I think I'm going to leave us still at port and not take off just yet. For all the notoriety that this movie has, unlike a lot of bad movies, infamously bad movies, I find this one eminently watchable without the use of substances designed to inebriate or enhance your experience of watching it. I watched this by myself and had a great time for those 85 minutes. And that point I want to highlight, it's only 85 minutes. And this doesn't feel like I'm watching a 2-hour movie that's in reality only an hour and a half. I'd love to know the thought process when they were putting this thing together, because this is like a Maximum Overdrive situation where the co-writer of this movie should be listed as cocaine. And then the writers could be other substances depending on what was used. And I'm pretty sure they went through them all, because there's no internal logic. There's no attempt to explain the psychic connection. You have to take it strictly as that because of how it's depicted. But goddamn, is this thing entertaining. Like, to me, this is more so bad it's good than something like Batman and Robin, because it's not 2 hours. and I don't feel like I'm being browbeaten. Although both of them killed the franchise, you know, their franchises, as did Superman 4. So they all have that in common. But of those three, this is far and away my favorite. I'm with Adam. I'm giving this a 6, strictly on enjoyment. And I apologize to Nate in advance if he's listening, because I know he hates this movie. But I can't bring myself to hate this.
Oh, wow. 2 6s for Jaws the Revenge. You know, call me the ever optimistic, but I do not believe that filmmakers get involved in a movie with the intentions of making a bad movie. I don't think there's any way Joseph Sargent, Michael De Guzman, Sid Sheinberg all got together and said, let's make a really, really bad movie. And when this was released, it just took a beating from critics. What did not make that much money, it was a box office flop. Internationally, it did a little over $55 million, but still, for the budget that it had, it did not warrant making any more. And Carl Gottlieb is famous as saying, A, he has never seen this movie, and B, the only movies in franchises that don't make any money are the final ones. And that's what we have here. As far as the movie itself, don't get me wrong, it's bad. It's really bad. The shark is inept. What it shows is just how good of a filmmaker Spielberg had, because he had sharks that were just as inept, but he's able to film around them and film it in a way that made it menacing. This shark is not menacing. This shark swims from Amity to the Bahamas and stalks a family. How ridiculous is that? I remember I was watching this, Adam, with our good friend Omar, and I brought the tape over to his house, and he was like, it's swimming and stalking the family? And we had a good laugh at it, and that's exactly what you get when you put this on. You're going to have a good laugh. I do think, going back to my original point, though, they made this with all serious intentions. I think Lorraine Gary is trying to give a performance that says, yes, this shark is attacking my family, and I am distressed over it. As it is, we get the distraction of Michael Caine, knowing that he had flown over here to not attend the ceremony where he won an Oscar is an absolute joy. Second movie in a row that we have an Oscar winner follow up their Oscar-winning movie with a Jaws film that was not good. This movie is notorious, and I have read articles, I have listened to podcasts trying to defend this movie. There's no defending this movie. What I will say about this movie, I'll agree with my two colleagues about this. It's fun to watch. I think if you haven't seen it, you have to. Just to kind of bask in how unbelievably stupid it is, but how much fun it is to watch. And if you're a fan of The Last Starfighter, you will get a lot of joy out of it because you get Alex Grogan here. Like, it's just so funny watching this movie, knowing that. So I can't go as high as my other two colleagues, though, because this is a pretty bad movie. However, given how fun it was to watch, it's 1 point higher than last week's movie. I'm going to go ahead and give this a 5 just because it's fun to watch, yet cannot credit any of the filmmaking going on here because it's pretty bad. So 5 out of 10 for Jaws the Revenge. As Matt mentioned, Jaws Revenge killed this franchise. We have had no more Jaws movies in the 30-something years since this movie had come out. Yes, they did make a Jaws 5. Some Italian filmmaker made a movie called Cruel Jaws and attached Jaws 5 to it. Not worth putting in this retrospective. It's not an official movie. God knows, I think the ridiculousness of this, and Adam, tell me if you agree with this. The ridiculousness of this is why our buddy Anthony Ferrante was able to go on and make a whole set of movies about shark tornadoes, right?
Absolutely. I think this leads into that. I will take those as spiritual sequels to Jaws more than I will so many other ones. But yeah, at this point, all you could do is go crazy. I don't need this done in a realistic way. Go crazy, and other than that, leave it alone.
Yeah, we've had shark movie after shark movie in the years since this movie has come out. The Meg plays with this, 47 meters down. I just watched The Shallows a few weeks ago. That has a shark that stalks Blake Lively for a while. But they also threatened to do a remake for a bit. They had a remake in mind with Tracy Morgan, of all people, as the lead. And that, fortunately, went by the wayside. Matt, if anything, Hollywood has proven that nothing is sacred. Do you think there will ever come a time, even with this 50th anniversary going on right now, that we will get a remake of Jaws?
Not until Spielberg's in the grave. I think if it's ever going to happen, that will be the only way. I'm trying to be optimistic. I'm trying to be like Superman, where I believe in humanity. But I don't think there is such a thing as a movie that is sacred to remakes. If I think there's some that may very well never get, like Citizen Kane, I don't see that ever getting a remake. The Godfather, Casablanca, because other filmmakers look at the approach of, we're going to make like our version of The Godfather or our version of Jaws rather than an official remake. But if it gets announced, I won't be surprised. I mean, the fact they're talking about a Back to the Future remake still surprises me. And I kind of put them, as far as like pop culture, they're kind of like two of the most well-known movies ever made. So fuck me if it happens.
I think Matt's right that if they remake Jaws specifically, it will not be as long as Spielberg is alive. I hate using that. I hate even thinking about that because I do think he's our greatest living filmmaker still.
He's like fifth. I can give you the four right now.
I'm not saying his current output, but I don't think if you need it, because I think, to your point, now you just put out a shark movie and that's all you need to do. So I don't know if the Jaws name would matter more than doing Megalodon 3. You know, I just don't know if it matters anymore. Jason Statham, this time it's personal. So it's possible, but I don't know. I think we may get Jaws 75th anniversary before we see Jaws 5 or a Jaws remake.
Well, let's do our rankings real quick. I mean, it's not going to take long. I'll go first. Gee, I'm going to go 1, 2, 4, and 3 is my ranking. Matt?
1, 4, 3, 2.
Wow. 2 is on the bottom. Adam?
Jaws, Jaws the Revenge, Jaws 3D, and Jaws 2.
You guys both have the Revenge as number 2.
We both have the exact same order.
We got this. Yep.
That's incredible. All right, well, people who listen to the end credits of this show will know that our schedule maker is Matthew Goudreau, and we have another series coming up. And oh boy, why don't you announce this, because it's kind of one we've worked on before, isn't it?
In both ways. We've done the spinoffs on this site. We did the most recent entry, and then at the old place, we did an actual full retrospective. I guess we can say we're getting to the chopper here on Percolated Media, because we're doing Predator. For not one new Predator movie, but two that are going to be released in 2025. I mean, one's already out, mm-hmm. and by the time this is out, Badlands might actually be released in theaters.
Incredible. We're going to be getting a new Predator movie in theaters. Now, Adam, you are a huge Predator fan, at least yes. a fan of the character. What are you expecting when we get into this particular retrospective?
I think we are going to get as much variety in the way of highs and lows than we get through some of these. I think we're going to get an amazing kickoff, and then I think we are going to look like an EKG of someone having a heart attack of up and down throughout the rest of this series. And we're going to have fights, we're going to have agreements, and we're going to have some words at each other for some of these films. But you love Alien, and I love the Alien movie series, but the Predator was the creature that I freaking adored growing up. So I can't wait to discuss this Predator series.
Yeah, that's what I thought of when we're leading up to this, is we got my series out of the way last year, and now we're getting to your series. But we are getting to a movie also, Adam, that even as much as you love the Predator character, you've never been able to finish one of these movies. So once again, we're going to have you watch a movie that you swore you would never watch again when we get to The Predator, right?
That's multiple times. I mean, I want to say this will be my fifth attempt, so wish me luck, everybody.
Well, stay tuned for that retrospective, guys. I gotta tell you, this has been one of the most fun retrospective series we have done. I love the fact that coming in, Adam had not seen any of these sequels, and all of these shows proved to be about as animated as you could get without being animated, with Adam just unleashing hate on my second favorite movie of the series, Jaws 2. And Adam, would you say you watched 2, 3, 4 for the first time? Was this a fulfilling series for you?
Absolutely joy. Absolute joy. And as someone who's about to go to Universal and walk on the Amity Island set here coming up, or at least the recreation of it, I'm going to enjoy it that much more. So absolutely pleased and glad that I was able to go through all of these films with y'all. I'm grateful for it.
Well, next week we're going to go from an inept shark to Arnold. So tune in next week when we get to Predator, kick off our Predator series. But until next week, Shark Podcast, Jake. Thank you, boys.
But I'm telling you, and I'm telling everybody at this table, that that's a shark. And I know what a shark looks like because I've seen one up close. And you better do something about this one, because I don't intend to go through that hell again.
Thank you for listening to this edition of the Three Men in a Retrospective podcast, exclusively here on Percolated Media.
He did it! He did it! Did you see it? He did it!
Come back every Friday as new retrospective reviews are posted weekly on your favorite podcast platform of choice.
You know, you want to let that breathe for nothing.
And if you would be so kind, please take a moment and give us a positive review and rating on your podcast platform of choice.
Don't have to take this abuse much longer.
It truly helps others find and discover this podcast.
slower, Hedge. I can go slower, Hedge. Come on down and chum some of this shit.
Check out the Percolated Media Archives, as we have tons of franchise reviews, including the Planet of the Apes franchise, Star Wars,
the ongoing Marvel series,
Pirates of the Caribbean, Indiana Jones,
the Exorcist films,
Avatar, Jurassic Park, and so many more.
You're gonna need a bigger boat.
Stop playing with yourself, Hooper!
A 3 Men in a Retrospective podcast is produced by Garrett and Matt.
Hey! Watch how you're cutting that thing, it's critical!
The 3 Men in a Retrospective podcast is edited by Garrett.
Excuse me, Chief.
That's great! That's just great! Now where the hell are we, huh?
Scheduling done by Matt.
They made me go with him.
The 3 Men and a Retrospective podcast is voice narrated by Adam.
Holy shit!
This podcast is not affiliated with any film studio or network, and all opinions expressed on the 3 Men in a Retrospective podcast represents the opinions of that individual. Any similarities to any and all things associated with the films in question are strictly coincidental.
How the hell you do that, man? It wasn't easy, believe me.
You better watch yourself with that fancy electrical equipment down there, buddy.
Such a live wire, liable to make your hair stick up funny.
That's good, Michael.
The 3 Men in a Retrospective podcast is an independently produced podcast, and it's thanks to the support of listeners like you that help keep it that way. Please like and subscribe, as well as leave a review on your favorite podcast platform of choice.
A what?
Get me, you son of a bitch.
This podcast is a Percolated Media production. Copyright 2025, and any and all sound and audio clips are used for entertainment purposes only.
Now why don't you take a long, close look at this sign? Those proportions are correct.
Love to prove that, wouldn't you? Get your name into the National Geographic.
This off?
Uh-huh.
Right away, guys, I really did want to give this movie a shot, but I have to say, this is pretty inept. Adam?
I think we broke him already.
I think we did.
Sorry, I just got distracted by a door knock.
Okay, everything okay?
Yeah. No, everything's fine. Sorry, are you talking about the going out to sea?
Let me go to Matt first, because he's the one who heard me.
I'm sorry.
No, you're okay. Matt, what do you think about this kill? You text us during this movie like, holy shit, what is Lance Guest doing in this movie?
Oh my god, it took me a minute, because he shows up and I'm like, man, that's that the eyes are familiar, you know, but he's got the beard, and I'm like, Daryl Hall? No, this isn't Hall & Oates. I'm just like, what the? And then it hit, and I'm like, oh my god, greetings, Starfighter.
Oh. All I see is Jimmy from Halloween 2.
Yeah, that too. Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
that
yeah.
too. He was also in a pretty terrible episode of The X-Files, where animals got loose.
are, Are there good episodes of The X-Files?
There are tremendous episodes of The X-Files.
Well, also, like, because that was season two when they were still trying to figure out, like, you would get two bad episodes for every good one.
Uh-huh.
And it's probably also how Michael Crichton got inspired to write Zoo.
My goodness. So we're...
Maybe it's like Highlander 3 where it's a separate timeline.
Maybe. Adam, remember me and you rented that movie with him solo? Remember that?
Oh, God. Yeah.
When I was working for the video store.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
I can't believe we admitted that on record. But yeah.
That's going to be a blooper, but...
Hey, that solo's better than the one that Disney put out a few years ago.
Oh, my goodness. All right, so let's move on. Mike's...
It gets pierced and explodes like a freaking balloon.
Guys, I really have to use the restroom. God damn, I wish I could hold it. Hold on.
God damn it. Go ahead. Oh, shit. Oh, my cat's looking at me like she doesn't know why I'm laughing.